seeing on Facebook the progress of your rehearsal and building the program and all the work you've been doing on this, which is just amazing. It's really an intense labor. And when did you start?
Oh, about 40 years ago. Well, this is a kind of a return for me. It's been a great adventure. Because when I was younger, I was very, how can I say, I was very intense about the art of playing the flute. I wanted to play it as well as I could. I had some wonderful teachers, worked very hard. I had some wonderful colleagues. I had a very active life in music, and I was kind of feeling like a pioneer because I wanted to be a flute soloist. And all those things happened in a wonderful way for me when I was younger. And then there came the time when I thought, all right, this is enough. It's time to leave it to the next generation. I think I should stop playing now because I've played enough and it's been wonderful and bye-bye, and I'm going to teach and I'll play as well as I can to demonstrate well for my students. But as far as concertizing, I think I've had enough. And so then my husband, after about a couple of months of this, after this decision, he said, Paula, you'd better start playing again because you're in a terrible mood. Because it was just kind of, without the flute in my hands, it's part of my voice, and without the actual experience of performing to people and with people, because I've always felt that the audience is very much part of the process, I'm just not complete as a human being. So I just felt, here I'm teaching at a school, New England Conservatory, wonderful students, wonderful artistic community, and they have this marvelous concert hall, Jordan Hall. And when I first started teaching there in the 70s, I gave a recital. And so I was just thinking, let's get that spark back. You know, let's get that hope springs eternal and hope is the thing with feathers on and all that stuff. Let's get that back, Paula. So I thought, well, let's try it. To do the kind of work necessary to prepare a recital like that is something that I haven't done for quite a while. So it was an adventure. It was a real adventure.
I didn't realize that. I know you don't play often, but I did hear that last year, and I didn't realize you'd cut back in any way.
Well, I did. I made a big cut back when we had our daughter Elizabeth. That was a time when I was still going on the road with Ruth Laredo, playing duo concerts and going out there and playing whenever I could, but it was always under great stress because I wanted nothing more than to come back home and be with my wonderful husband and daughter. So, but I still kept doing it and out there on the road. And then, as my daughter says, Mommy, when you come home, you smell of jet fuel and cocoa, which is the perfume that I wear. Then when she grew up, it was a question of whether to go back to it in a really major way or not. And to be honest with you, because I know that you understand what I do, I don't think everyone has understood through the years exactly what it is that I've been looking for with the flute. I mean, why play the flute? Why try to go beyond what the flute is capable of doing? I always wanted to go beyond, because I thought there was much more to the instrument than people were willing to, how can I say, invest in or understand or try to cultivate what the possibilities of the instrument are. It's such an ancient instrument, and it's in every culture. But in Western culture, there's a whole body of repertoire that I really wanted to play in the most developed way possible. That's in a big parenthesis. My Proustian sentences here, comma. So where was I? Yes, to go back to that kind of intensity, it was a decision that takes a lot of just practicing and working and to get the language polished up again. And looking at this marvelous hall, which resembles in a lot of ways my other all-time favorite hall in the world, which is Carnegie. And I've been fortunate enough to play a lot in that hall in Carnegie. And it has a wonderful kind of way that when you walk on the stage, it embraces you. The hall itself has arms stretched out to embrace you, so you can't be nervous. You just have to be happy to be there. You know, it just is welcome to an artist. And Jordan has the same how can I say, attitude towards the performer walking onto the stage. Although, of course, since it's a hall in Boston, the seats are a little quirky and the balcony kind of comes down on the side. It's not New York, it's Boston, where we have to be a little bit different and a little bit eccentric. And that's marvelous. It's such a marvelous
It's a wonderful hall. And I've been going there since I was 18. And I appreciate it more and more. Fortunately, the past few years, I go there more than ever. So
that's wonderful.
And I just love the sound with a whole range of different things. With the Boston Early Music Festival, and you're buried in there for several days.
Marvelous
and,
thing here.
And just wonderful to hear. These very quiet instruments, recorders and small lutes and what have you. And they just sound wonderful in that hall.
They do. They sound wonderful because the sound travels and it lasts a bit. And you can play the hall almost like an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
It has its own kind of acoustic. And
yeah, in the Franck yesterday, there was a wonderful bloom around your sound.
Oh, good, good, yay! Yeah, we were thinking with the Franck, we wanted to go towards the center of that space in the hall. That's how I felt about that piece, that it was to bloom in that big round reverberating space in the center of the audience part of the hall.
Mm.
Yeah, you can play a great hall, you can play the hall, you play it like an instrument.
Yeah, I've seen some musicians actually go back and forth during a performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, flute sounds great in there. There's some halls which are cruel to the flute as an instrument because flute needs a little bloom around the sound. We just need a little space. And I remember people used to really complain about the old Alice Tully Hall in New York.
Mm-hmm. How do you like the new one?
I like it very much. I like the new hall very much for to perform in. Yes, I played in the old Alice Tully Hall for 20 years in a row as a member of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center when it was first formed, when the hall first opened. And I loved the old hall. I thought it was very elegant, plenty of space, and it bore the personality, the stamp of Alice Tully's vision and her aesthetic. And so there were many things about it which were wonderful. But as the years went by, it kind of wasn't cared for as it should have been, so it lost some of its reverberance for some reason. Contrary to other halls, it kind of seemed to gain it as the more spirits collect there. Alice Tully Hall got a little bit on the stuffy side, so it was harder to play the flute in there. And I know that early music groups just did not want to play in there because there was no place for the sound to go. It was very honest hall, just like Alice Tully was. She would decide on something, whether it was right or not. And that's how that hall seemed to sort of, you have to play well. I'm not going to help you. You know, I'm just doing, or I'm going to help you in secret, as Alice used to do. She was a great philanthropist. She would help people and never want her name associated with it. It was really she was quite an amazing woman. Anyway, I'm digressing here. But the new one, I know that Wuhan and David Finkel wanted, the directors of the society now, wanted the hall to be like a Stradivarius. They wanted the color of it to be like the color of a Stradivarius. They wanted it to feel like being inside a violin or a cello. And that's what it's like, to perform. I'm not sure about listening to music in there. It's a little bit, it's not elegant enough for me for the audience experience, as the old one was, with all the wood around and...
I was at one of the opening concerts, and I've been to other things since then, and I've always liked it, with one exception. Les Outfleurissants played a Rameau, two Rameau chamber operas there, and there was a kind of distant, velvety sound over the orchestra, and you couldn't hear the bite of the attacks. And it seemed rather distant. That was the only really unsatisfactory experience I had there. But I've heard some pianists who played there complain about it.
It has more of a feeling of distance than it used to. It feels like a larger hall than it used to be. I don't think there were any seats added. They brought the stage a bit out into the audience. I think not quite enough. It would have been nice to have it right way out there.
It looks big.
Yeah. What a science. What an art, a science, and a mystery. Mm-hmm. Building a good hall. We're all very excited here about the new Gardner Museum addition with a new concert hall in there. That's going to be very exciting.
Yes, I definitely want to find out about that when the time comes.
Yeah.
And then start going often.
January.
Yeah, not far off.
No. And again, this is such a Boston thing. As Isabella Stewart Gardner did, she opened her palace to the public on a January day in 03. In the middle of the winter in Boston, you know, and it's going to be the same now. They're going to open the new wing January 13th. And so I'm just thinking, how are people going to get in and out, and with all their ermine cloaks dragging behind in the snow, and the carriage is how they possibly going to come around and let people off? It's all
I was always wondering how we were talking last night about the renovations, and people will be coming in from the side.
Yes.
I guess. And then I was picturing Isabella Stewart Gardner's guests coming in the front entrance, which is so narrow. And what about the big dresses? And what about that? They must have had to pull themselves together a bit.
Yes, I think she wanted to make everyone suffer. She wanted to make them just draw themselves in and not be so grand, and then see what a marvel she had created there.
Yeah, then they come through.
Came in and up the stairs, and each one came by her, and she was wearing her famous black dress with a diamond. And I'm sorry I never got to meet her.
Mm.
But I feel that she's still there in that place. Her spirit is so much there. I think she'd be happy about what's going on there now.
I've done a fair bit of reading about her. And I was on a project about a Pinturicchio, Madonna and Child, that was very much of the same type as the one she has. Mm-hmm. Well, since it's in Cleveland, it's got to be bigger, of course, and all that. But I read the correspondence between Berenson and Isabella Stewart Gardner about this, and his selling technique was really something. Using these cables and codes, and you must let me know or we'll lose it, and that sort of thing. And
those letters are wonderful reading. Wonderful, very illuminating about the time and about those two particular people.
I'm very much into Berenson's wife right now, too, Mary. I'd like to be doing more about her. But she actually wrote The Venetian Painters. He provided a lot of input, and she developed quite a lot, learning about art from him. But he didn't have enough confidence in his English at the time to write an entire book. So she did the writing in that one. And then they collaborated quite a lot before. And as somebody who's worked in that field, as a connoisseur of drawings and Renaissance paintings, I know it from the inside. And it's a process of teamwork. And often it's a couple, a husband and wife, who work together, like Philip Pouncey, who is one of the greats from more recent time through the late 40s into the 90s. He died at quite an advanced age then, but he was someone who had been a keeper at the British Museum, and he wrote some books early on in his career, but he didn't like writing. And he ended up with a position with Sotheby's, where he was providing expertises and he could travel around and see everything. But he was always going with his wife, and they always looked at things together and bounced things off each other. And that's, again, what happens in museums. If you don't do this with your wife, you have colleagues, and it's all a process of teamwork, and not the the lone genius who catches mysterious vibes from a painting, which was something of Berenson's mystique.
But there has to be someone there making the soup.
Yeah.
Taking care of his shirts.
And looking at it and saying, don't, you may feel that way now, Bernard, but don't tell anybody else about
that. Has there been a book written about her?
Yes, there has.
Okay.
There are a couple, and I think there's more coming out.
Good. I'd like to know more about her.
Yeah, I'll let you know what I can find. She was the sister of Logan Pearsall Smith, who was a writer And they were both Quakers, and from an old Quaker family in Philadelphia. And they would write to each other with these and thous and in the old Quaker way. And he did this very abstruse kind of writing that didn't make him a lot of money. And they set him up in London as an antique dealer, and that sort of got him by a few years. But it's a very interesting... Sorry, we're not here to talk about this.
This is very interesting, very interesting, because it all reverberates so much here, too. Because up there is Green Hill, where she used to come during the summers, Isabella.
Mm-hmm.
And I've wondered about some of the paintings, you know, the ones that he said, oh, this is so great, you should have this. And maybe he was wheeling and dealing meanwhile with another dealer, another collector, and the things that she wound up with. It's such an interesting collection, because there, some of them are some of the finest examples of a painter's work, and others are, what? You know, why did you think this was so wonderful? But then there's a Masaccio, you know, the man in the red hat, that's just kind of stuck in a corner there, and she hung them in such a, what's the word? Not eccentric, but individualistic. There's another word. There's a better word.
There is something eccentric about the place.
It is.
Which is what makes it.
But Pierana Cavalcini, who's the curator of contemporary art at the Garrett Gardner now, says, the way she hung them was kind of to have a performance art, kind of a performance art thing. Or that you know, you had to participate in a certain way and be surprised. But to have to look at a fireplace, to have to know exactly where one of the greatest Fra Angelicos known is at the Gardner, you have to know where it is. You have to go. It's like driving in Boston. You have to know where you're going, or else you're just hopelessly lost. That painting, The Assumption of the Virgin Mary, is right around the corner of the Assumption, around a corner of the side of a fireplace, and it's just a divine little painting. Mm-hmm. And you can only see it when there's good light from outside.
Yeah, that's a wonderful thing about the place too, is the absence of artificial lighting, and those Renaissance works, Baroque works, and anything from a time when there was no incandescent lighting is really made to be viewed with natural light coming through the windows, and it looks totally different.
It does. And she used candlelight too. When she first moved in there, she didn't have any electric light in there. She used candles everywhere.
Really? Yeah, so there you are. And so it's I enjoy being in there in the winter, you know, and the light goes down almost
to
nothing.
Come to the opening, and we'll all have a party.
Yeah. I will. So one thing I wanted to ask you about the program is how you became interested in Sidney Lanier. I know you're from Tennessee, right? But did you leave early, or do you regard yourself as a Southerner? Is that...
Well, my parents were there, moved there, because my father was at that time a music historian, and he taught at Fisk University. And my parents were activists, social activists, and at that time the civil rights movement had not even begun.
Mm.
And, I mean, it was just starting, really. And so my father had a choice to either go and fight in Spain, or when he was offered this job at Fisk University, his friends, in fact, I was just reading his letter again, at the point where I was deciding whether or not to go on a freedom ride, he was talking, wrote a letter to me about what an artist must do, and sometimes it's better to you'll have a bigger effect and bigger, you'll take a bigger step towards world peace by being an artist and using your voice as an artist to send that message, maybe not in as physical a way or direct a way or immediate way. So instead of going to Spain, he went to Fisk, and they were so excited to be there it was at that time Fisk had a brilliant African-American student body, because there was still segregation, obviously, and they came from all over. They had this school has a tremendous history, and so they were part of what they felt was the beginning of that movement. And so they were there for probably a total of 5 or 6 years. But I feel as though, even though we moved to California and that's where I spent most of my young years, I feel a big tie to that, still that part of the country, and what has now, after all these years, what is still evolving there. But then my father decided he wanted to be a screen and playwright, and so they moved to Los Angeles, and my mother was an actor, and so they continue their activist work there, and had three children. But so Sidney Lanier, I had not really heard about. I was always a great lover of poetry. I always read poetry from a very young age and never wrote any, but just have read it assiduously and had a few favorites and kind of gravitated towards the ones who were more kind of about the road that I was on, nature and the flute, what the flute can express, which is that thing beyond that we don't really understand, the thing we hear in bird calls when they're singing. As Messiaen said, bird song is the hint we have in this life of what the harmonies of heaven might be like. He said that as in the introduction to his Quartet for the End of Time, magnificent work, which has a lot of bird calls in it. Of course, there's a lot of bird music in all of Messiaen's work. So Sidney Lanier's poetry was just something I started reading it, and oh my gosh, he's talking about those things. He's talking about walking around in a forest of oak trees and embracing the tree, you know, and the marshes and the light on the marshes of Glynn in the morning and the birds suddenly flying up from the marshes. And that's everything that the flute talks about. It's what composers usually, until this the end of the last century and this century, have asked us to do in their music. Now the flute is much more, can be violent and has also sort of extended techniques which have changed our roles somewhat. But so I always had known about him as a poet. And then one day my brother said, you know, Paul, and he's in the music field, and he said, did you know that Sidney Lanier was a flutist and that he wrote a piece called, I think it was called Blackbirds? And I said, what? What? And that was before the days of the internet, and I had no way of, I started trying to research it in libraries, and I tried to find out more about this, and then I found out there was another bird piece. And then a colleague of mine, whose name is Patricia Harper.
Yes, you edited the.
She had done also some research about him. So we decided to get together and get this music published so that flutists could play it. Mm. And so she had access. It turns out the collection was in the Johns Hopkins. There was some in the what's it called? In Washington.
Library of Congress, okay.
There was some information in the Library of Congress, some letters, I believe. And then I guess the manuscripts for his poetry. Okay, Patricia Harper had done some research at the Johns Hopkins Library and had gotten some of the manuscripts of these pieces. So one day she came over and we were looking at the manuscripts. She had copies of the manuscripts. And we were looking together at his poetry. She brought a big volume of his complete works, which she had had in the family for years. And we just said, we looked at each other and we just said, they're the same. The poetry is like the music. The poetry has the same cadences and has the same surprises and that are in the music. And so we thought, well, why don't we, luckily Universal, publishers in Vienna were interested in publishing this collection. And so we decided that we would put some of the poems or fragments, because in this volume there are fragments of poems also, mm-hmm. with the pieces. So we thought, we collected the ones which we thought were the best ones. There are a lot of fragments of, as there are of the poetry, there are a lot of fragments of the flute pieces, because he often would improvise. He would play his flute. In fact, when he was taken prisoner during the Civil War and was in prison, he played his flute, and some of the prisoners, his fellow inmates of Point Lookout Prison, said that he kept them alive just by the sound of his flute. He would play and play. So he was often improvising. But so to write down that kind of improvisation, he did it. Obviously, someone had asked him to write it down. So then there were a lot of corrections or things. He had built a special long extension on his flute so he could play really low notes, and so we had to figure out what to do with those. And Patricia is a real scholar, you know, so everything had to be totally notated with numbers and everything had to be explained. And then I was the one who was trying to get the gestures in there. She's a wonderful flute player too. So it was just, it was a marvelous project. And then we found a Hudson River School painting to put on the front of a man just walking by himself in the woods. And so the whole thing was just a wonderful coming together of art forms for us. And I recorded Windsong but had not really performed it a lot until this concert. I just got a request from Adam Workman, who was working with me on the concert, and he said, "I love Wind Song. Would you play Wind Song, please?" So that was for Adam Workman. And it sounded great in there, I thought. It was at home in there. Really,
it did,
Yeah. It's the wind. It's language. That's what he was trying to put into the poetry and into his flute playing also.
That's an amazing piece. Very strange.
It is.
I haven't really looked through it carefully, but it doesn't really have much of a harmonic structure. Does it?
No, it doesn't. It just goes very along. Improvisational.
Yeah.
And we decided, Adam and I, in fact, did something which is now on YouTube. Can we talk about YouTube on this?
Sure. Sure. I listened to that. Is that the one
with
you're talking about?
With Homer.
With the Homer, yeah.
Yeah. Well, suddenly I thought, Adam, why don't you, let's do this together. Because some of the Winslow Homer images of water being tossed by the wind and boats, men in boats, and it wasn't maybe what Sidney Lanier had in mind totally, but it was just kind of the images seemed to go very much with the music for me, so we had a lot of fun with that one too. It's fascinating combining those when they brush up against each other so strongly. It's fascinating seeing how they impact each other.
Yeah, it certainly is. I had never heard of him at all until I started looking into your concert program, and so polymaths of that sort are fascinating to me. So I immediately looked around and I read some of the poetry and. The one he wrote to Richard Wagner is fascinating. There's a lot in that. And I started reading his novel as well.
I don't even know his novel. I didn't even
know
he wrote
one. Yeah, there is a novel.
One.
And the text I read about it said it wasn't a success or anything. And it's very strange. He actually is imitating Tristram Shandy in it.
Oh, yes.
I think. He refers to it and... there are devices that are out of that.
When he was 39, he was gone.
Yeah.
He died young. So all of the things that he did were a young person's things and thoughts, and he didn't have time to really let them ferment.
In his opening chapter, it might be the second chapter actually, he actually describes a scene where these two men meet in the wilderness and become friends, which is straight out of a Hudson River School painting.
Exactly.
It's that same kind of landscape and these men scrambling up hillsides and rocks and standing on top of them and looking out into nature. Definitely shared that mentality.
Yeah, that aesthetic. And that's, again, just thinking the flute is there. That moment of the look and not just seeing the distance. And no instrument can speak about that as well as the flute can, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It just has it, because it's such an old instrument. And the Native Americans, that's the way they played it. They played it out there in the open land across long distances. And, and then the Greek flute players, if you just think, every civilization has had a drum, some sort of a string instrument, a dancer, a singer, and a flute player.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of the combo of our humanness.
So the Griffiths really backed that up with the nature feeling in that.
The Griffiths to me is a Native American piece. I haven't written about that extensively, but I do. There's one image which I like to show students, which I think is very closely related to the piece. The painter Ralph Albert Blakelock, who lived in New York at the same time that Griffiths did, and it's very possible that they knew each other. I don't know whether they did or not, but this is something that I just feel the kinship there. He did a lot of moonlight paintings, a lot of paintings of dark trees at night against the sky with the moon either shining through the trees or onto the landscape, dark, black, and then the brightness of the sky with a full moon. And one of them is in the Brooklyn Museum. It's just called Moonlight. And there's the moon, there's a tree, and there's a rise of ground. And to on the left side of the painting, in the lower area, there's a a wigwam of some kind, a campfire, and some people sitting around talking, obviously telling some sort of story. And then on the rise of ground, there's one single man on a horse with his arms stretched out and is just looking up at the moon, just his head is completely raised to the moon. And when I saw that, it was just an epiphany, because that looking at the moon, the moment that tranquillo as marked in the music, when there's just a held chord in either the piano or the strings, depending on how it's played, is that moment to me when the flute just has a long line of just stillness, of looking at the moon. And it's possible that it is like the Native Americans saying, this is our land, this is our history, this is who we are, and we are here. And it's like around the fire, they're telling the story of, you know, their history. And all through the piece, there's dancing, there are drums, there's the maidens, you know, lovely lilting dance. And I don't think, some have said there's an Orientalist influence in the piece because there's tambourine in the orchestra. And others say that it's kind of a Scottish or Irish kind of lilting thing. I don't think so. I think it's a very totally American piece and totally... I have no idea, I have nothing to back this up, except that Griffiths, around the same time, was writing some Indian dances, four-string quartet. Hmm. So I found them, thanks to the internet. My gosh, what a wonderful source. So I have them, and there is a similarity to the way they sound and the way the last part of the poem is.
Oh, I can hear that.
So, yeah.
Did he do the piano version himself?
Yes, he too, like Lanier, was dying. Deathly ill in his 30s. And Georges Barrère, for whom he wrote the piece, great flutist, French, who moved to America, said, we must have, and I've been in this situation too, we must have a piano reduction. We must, and Griffiths was saying, I'm too sick, I can't do this now, I can't, I'm only trying to stay alive. This is really in the last month of his life. And Barrère was saying, okay, we'll do it. And so probably it's that they did it together. That Griffiths probably said, okay, do this here and put this in the piano, and then Barrère would say, is this all right, or whatever. I don't know. Again, we only can imagine what was actually going on. But I love the piano version. People since have made other additions with more of the orchestral interludes inserted in the piano version. But I really don't like those, because I think the one we played last night is so spare and so pure that it really evokes the whole character of the piece in a different way than one hears when you hear the flute and orchestra, because that flute and orchestra is much more lush. You know, you get much more of the aura all around the moon in that one, and more of the shaking tambourine and the drums. But with the piano, especially the way Catherine Shee played it, I thought she played marvelously.
Oh, yeah, she's great.
She is really a unique artist.
Mm-hmm.
Working with her has been such a joy. Both in the Piero Lunaire, which you heard, and in this. It's just, I think we're going to continue to play together.
She's a very powerful personality.
Yes.
And one of the wonderful things about the concert was that you both were there 100%. And
yes.
I knew only the orchestral version of the Griffiths, but I thought Griffiths must have had a hand in this reduction, because... Mm-hmm. The kind of intense interaction you two had going could only really work in piano. You know, maybe with Orpheus or something like that, you could get that kind of responsiveness from an orchestra. But he really did things that can't be done in the orchestral version.
Good, yeah. I think the colors she got out of the instrument were wonderful. Yeah. And that's a wonderful piano, a Homburg Steinway.
Is that one of the standards in the conservatory?
Yes, there are two Steinways. There's an American Steinway in the Hamburg, and she's played there a lot. And we tried both pianos on one rehearsal, and we both thought this was better for what we were doing.
Yeah,
for her voice, this is much more her voice.
Yeah, it's on. And then you went to the French Salon from there, and that was totally convincing. I thought it was quite a strong piece. I was surprised. I expected just display, and you did some incredible passages there, virtuosic passages, and you made that clear enough. But you played it as real music, And it was expressive and involving, and the piece is not fluff at all.
I totally agree with you. And a lot of those French pieces are marvelous, they're beautiful, they're fun to play, but they are all about virtuosity and display. That's their purpose. And that's fun. It's fun, fine to play them. But I have always felt that this piece was an exception. That even among the works of Tafanel, and there are many, this one stands out. But there are probably several reasons for that. First of all, it's based on an opera, which I had not really known. I had just known parts of it. So I was studying Carlos Kleiber's recording of it, the complete opera. Mm. And I was blown away by how great the music is from beginning to end in that opera. And Weber's music, I know very well. I've played a lot of it. And it also had impressed me as being on the light side for the most part. Wonderfully entertaining. But this opera is so profound and so advanced, and I'm sure it had an influence on Wagner and further.
Oh yeah, big one.
Yeah, and the story is so beautiful, but there's nothing sentimental about the way it's told. It's really about redemption and really about the power of good to prevail, and the true power of evil in this world, and how present it is. And in everyone, the possibility of the opportunity to sell your soul that's presented to us every day in some form or another. So all that said, I think Tafanel was able to capture some of that in the piece. And I taught it for years, and I studied it with my teacher, Marcel Mouys, who loved the piece. Oh, Freischütz, so beautiful, great masterpiece, you know. And so I was always studying it and teaching it, and then suddenly I thought, well, it's time to get down to this. If I'm going to give this recital and redefine myself, I better just play this thing. And so about 6 or 7 months ago, I started to work on it, and I kept saying to my students, this thing is so hard. It's so hard. They're saying, yeah, it is. And then I posted that I was going to play it, and oh, you're playing Freischütz. And I said, okay, now I'm in for it. I really have to do this thing now. So my poor husband, he'll tell you, he just heard the same passages over and over again because I felt like a dancer. Really, I just had to go to that bar, do my warm-ups, and then do around the room, around the room, around the room, go to the corner, get ready, do the 24-foot, whatever it is, because that's what the virtuosic part about it is. But I didn't want it to be just that, because I wanted that to pass and be part of the way it does in Swan Lake. You know, that's really a ballet that's very profound if you look at it that way. And all the virtuosic display in it is for a larger, as part of a larger work of art. And this, in miniature, is sort of like that. I mean, from the beginning of, the very beginning of the piece, it's just terrifying, I think, the way he wrote it. And then going to that marvelous theme of redemption right away in the introduction. And then Liza, to go into that aria of Agata, where she's saying, you know, be still, my heartbeat, know that he will triumph and have faith, and how beautiful the night is and the stars are. I start crying thinking about it. But then, it was wonderful preparing it with Kathy, who had performed it. Kathy Chi had played the piece before, so she helped me enormously. And then it was right up to the last minute of, that's why it was really funny when I had to tell everybody. I wasn't going to tell everybody it was my first performance, but I felt like that audience was so much family that I could just say that. And they were so with me. That was funny the way they started to applaud in the middle. It was just like...
Not all that many people have heard it.
No, yeah.
I had a sense somehow there must be something else coming.
Yeah. But it was great. It was really funny. Isn't it way part of it? Because yeah.
Did you see the production of Freischütz? They did it at Pro Boston a couple of years ago.
No.
Yeah, it was musically. It was very good, I thought. And I was so excited to have a chance to see it on the stage. I'd never done that. The Met gave up doing it a long time ago. And there's a wonderful recording I've listened to, Furtwängler from the Salzburg Festival.
Yes, I have that one too. Yeah, it's a great work of art.
I'll have to get back to that one.
Yeah, so I think Freischütz is going to stay in my repertoire now.
Yeah, you should record it.
I should. Yeah, also it was a friend of mine, a colleague, who said last year we were working at, he had come from a masterclass. A dear friend from Germany came to give a class, Andoyan, great flutist. And one of the students played it for him. And I said, oh, I've never played it. And he said, looked at me, he said, oh, that would have been a great piece for you. And then he felt so sad that he said, was said that would have been. In other words, that I was too old to play it now, you know. When I was young, it would have been. So I was thinking, that was another stimulus. I'm not, you know, I want to give it a try. So anyway, there it is. Now it's home. I hope it'll get better. Because that's what I'm really trying to do, is keep getting better.
Yeah.
I hope I can.
Yeah.
I hope God gives me the strength to continue to grow as an artist, too.
Sure, you can. Adam mentioned something about no one really, from your generation, still playing with the kind of energy you bring to it.
Oh, yeah, it's possible. I think everyone else is more sensible. I don't know. It's a type of insanity.
Sorry, insanity, yeah. Yeah,
I'm a maniac. I mean, who also would do a Piero Lunera, you know, my age? What?
Yeah, it seems the flute doesn't give you enough of a workout, enough of a physical workout. But this kind of intensity and engagement in each phrase and each note strikes me as something that comes from Marlborough. But perhaps you got into that before going there.
Well, Marlborough was a huge influence on me, and I'm grateful that you've done so much writing about the place, because it's unique. There's no place like it. I started going there at a very early age. I was 21 or something. I mean, that's relatively early. And I guess, yes, I was influenced by it. I was first influenced by studying with Marcel Mouys. And his playing was that way. He was intense, extremely intense, and involved with the way the music developed. He was a great artist, not just a wonderful flutist. He was a highly developed artist with a great fantasy. And so I already was kind of starting to grow from him. And then he said, Paula, you must come to Marlborough and you work with me there. And so I went to a workshop of his there, and then I actually was invited to go there. And so I was there at the time when Pablo Casals was also there. And I'm grateful to you for linking me with him in some way, because he was very influential, because he was 88, something like that at the time. He would, at a masterclass, he would sit and then he would put that boat down. He had to be led onto the stage. He had to be kind of put into his chair, and then he put that bow on the string, and a sound came out that was just amazing, astounding. That was the same with Marcel Mouys. He was not performing at all when I was studying with, but he would put the flute to his lips and a sound would come out that was so, only a person that age can make a sound like that, based on a life of growth. Those two artists did not stop. They didn't stop at a certain place and say, okay, this is fine. I have my voice. I'm going to keep this voice for the rest of my life. No, they continued to grow and listen and be affected by everything they saw and experienced. And so the sound was so rich, you know, so full of intensity. And both of those artists, and also Alexander Schneider, who was that during those years, was a big influence, because he was a maniac, more of a maniac, like sort of closer to what I am. But he would say, I'm trying to remember the exact words he would use, but he would always make us say something that meant something. He didn't want us just to play beautifully. It had always have some meaning and purpose. And so I guess, and then Rudolf Serkin was that way, to an extreme. I mean, the man, Rudolf Serkin, was not able to sit at a piano like Rubinstein and relax and play a Chopin etude. He couldn't do it. He was so intense. Everything was in the keys, and his whole body was involved. And so when he and I worked on the Schubert Variations together, which took a summer, and then we performed it, and it was just amazing. Then we did a couple of other performances of it. It was an experience of extreme intensity. And so that all did affect me quite early on. And so that's where I was thinking that the flute can be more than pretty. No one else was doing that then. no other women either. So I felt very lonely. It was the road less traveled, very definitely. So, but somehow those people gave me the impetus to
Felt, I should say, I've always been a great admirer of Rudolf Serkin's playing. And I used to go hear him when I was a student in England in the early 70s. And he loved playing in the Festival Hall in London. And he seemed to have a special kind of relationship with that audience. And he would loosen up a little bit. And they loved everything he was doing. Mm. And his playing was quite different there than at Carnegie.
Interesting.
Or in the States, he seemed more self-conscious and limited in the States. But maybe it was just because I was in a better mood, God knows. But in any case, some people thought he was limited by the influence of Toscanini. But it seems to have been that he would never let himself go and radically do a radical rallentando and start a completely new phase, say, in the kind of passage, you know, the kind of passage I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to be a tremendous struggle for him. And the conflict between expression, which he knew, and he was exposed to that around the bushes, and this kind of discipline he was imposing on himself.
Highly disciplined, highly. But I think it's also, he may have felt, as I think a lot of American artists do, playing in the UK or playing in Europe, a tremendous relief. We feel like we're playing for people who know the music, you know, and it's just, it's a physical relief. I mean, you feel much more free because you can feel that you're playing for people who are listening with educated ears. There are some audiences like that in the United States. I think one of them was at Marlborough, so he probably felt he did some extraordinary playing there. And there are audiences in New York, there are audiences here in Boston who are educated, and there are in other cities in the United States. But in a way, in the United States, there's a kind of a fear and a resistance to becoming knowledgeable about music and the arts in general. It's part of our kind of stance, I think. It's changing to a certain extent, but there's still a definite difference in the feeling of playing for audiences here and there.
Yeah, I don't know what to say about that. Naturally, I meet a lot of people who are pretty knowledgeable and go to concerts all the time. But when you go out into the world, you know, when you go 600 miles to the west, it's different.
It's different. It depends on the city. There are some cities where there is a very, very passionate group of music lovers. And now, if just keeping it to just music listeners. I think in America you kind of have to assume, however, that most people, well, of course, the instrument I play means that the music I'm playing, it makes it more likely that people have not heard it. I have to be prepared for that. But even playing works that are more well-known in chamber music groups and so on, I think the assumption is that the audience has not heard the piece. Just here, just in general. Not in the larger metropolitan areas, but just in general, touring in the United States, and I've done a lot of that. And that in itself is an adventure, because my attitude has always been, well, great, you've never heard it. Let's give you an experience. Like, maybe this is going to change your life then. Maybe it's going to open up something for you. Maybe you're going to want to listen to it again now. You know, maybe you're going to want to know more about Debussy, for instance. You know, you're always an adventurer, I think, here in this country. We still have a great sense of adventure here. People are also more open to things. Being more knowledgeable means having more opinions too sometimes, and so you can meet some resistance in that way. I always dreamed though that the flute would become, as a solo instrument, well enough known, and there would be enough players of the instrument. This was when I was first starting out, and there were very few of us, maybe two or three, you know, were doing the kind of playing that I was doing. And now there are hundreds. And so I'm glad, because people can say, well, not this person is the best or better, blah, blah, but I prefer, that person is wonderful, but I prefer this person, the playing of this one. And people are getting more knowledgeable about the art of flute playing, which is a lot of fun for me to witness.
So, yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Well, one thing that crossed my mind was that, well, back in the 70s, say, And before, I was a little off-put by the kind of cult that arose around, you know, certain very great players. Ron Powell.
James Galway.
And yeah. And, you know, you became very famous very young, but you never got into that.
No, and it was not because I didn't want to. I really did. I was very ambitious, and I really wanted to be in that world. But somehow, I don't know why, it was denied to me. I don't know why. I've had a wonderful life, so, and I've done a lot of other things and had a lot of other interests, which probably was part of it, because I didn't have blinders on and I wasn't thinking only of my life as a flutist. And there were a lot of other things that were interesting to me, including my family. Mm-hmm. So, and other areas of research and interest and teaching's always been very important to me. So I've never been able to figure it out. Scott and I have talked about it. Why? You know, I didn't wind up in that realm. But it's great.
Think of it as a loss. you accomplished great things. And as I say, when that was at its height, I always found it a little off-putting at the time.
And, well, I guess anybody who has a star career, there's a certain amount of, I won't use the slang word for it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of stuff that goes on around it. But that's kind of part of the picture. It's part of the... I think that I prefer to play... How can I say this? I like people to understand what I'm doing. I guess because I've always thought of the flute as kind of a way of communicating something.
Yeah, very direct opening kind of up. Instrument.
Yeah. So I'm grateful for the life I've had, and I'm glad I'm still here. I'm really glad I'm still alive and healthy, and I hope that that more adventures lie around the corner, the ones maybe that I don't.
Yeah, you're certainly out looking for them.
Yeah, and I guess when you're open to them, they're there, because they're always around us, the opportunities and possibilities for friendships, and it's always there. I guess you just have to kind of catch the wave. I feel that any artist, any performing artist, is, of course, a creative artist. Not in the sense that a composer is. I'm not a composer. I'm an interpretive artist. Nevertheless, I can catch the spirit of the composer, whether it's Mozart or Leon Kirchner, you know, somebody of a long time ago, somebody right here, or somebody who's writing right now. So I'm part of a continuum as an interpreter. And without us interpreters, the notes are just there, lying there on a page. And so we have to, it's our responsibility, it's our sacred duty to bring it to life. And so I guess I've always felt that that's been my responsibility, so I'm still open to doing it, and so I hope that, as I say, that God gives me the strength to continue.
Yeah,
because it's a God-given thing. I really feel always acknowledgement of that and thanks for that, giving grace really before walking on stage, because it's that we're all, as artists, we're part of something that's larger and beyond ourselves. We just are. And seeing it in that realm, in that light, has been what's made it possible for me to go on, even in the face of some really difficult times. Still, I've just felt that there's always just like a move just a little bit to the left or right, and then suddenly the pathway opens, and with help and asking and praying. Mm-hmm. And that's an important part of it for me.
Yeah, fantastic. While you still have some voice left, I'd like to ask you about one other thing. You have a whole separate repertoire of spiritual music. Not spirituals, of course, but you've made a series of recordings. And can you explain that to me, and how you got into that? And
I don't know how I got into it. I guess I was always there. And the tangible, the kind of results about it, which are the two albums, which are called Places of the Spirit, were done in conjunction and collaboration with the Pucker Gallery here in Boston on Newbury Street. Bernie Pucker, Bernie and Sue Pucker run this gallery. Wonderful people. And there's an artist named Jim Shantz who lives in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, who's a pastel artist. And there was something about his paintings that always appealed to me. It's just something lovely about him, the way he is able to catch the light and paint. Most of his work is about the Berkshires, which is a part of the world that I just think is so magical and has a light that's just unlike any other place I've ever been. And so Bernie said, well, why don't we collaborate on something? Let's just do this. Let's you look at some of Jim's work and then just play some music that you think is appropriate or evokes some of the same ideas of the paintings. And we'll record it and we'll put a book out called Places. And we were thinking of the title, we couldn't for a long time. And then I just came up with Places of the Spirit, because that it's where the spirit, you kind of where you go beyond yourself and you go into a place that's just something you don't really understand, but can be maybe expressed partially by music and partially by art. I'm not one who likes to kind of like make music while someone else is painting or have the two processes combined at the moment. I think that artists, at least in my own experience, I can look at like a Sollowit picture like that. Look at the lines that interchange and think, how does it affect, how is it similar to what I'm doing in the music of Bach? And so it can inspire me to play Bach maybe slightly in a different way. So that's what happened with this particular project. So we did one, Places of the Spirit, the Berkshires, a lot of solo flute, a lot of nature sounds. A friend of mine got bird calls and the thrush, the hermit thrush, and then my great friend Ciro Baptista, who's a great Brazilian percussionist, came in and did some of his magic.
Oh, right, he played with you.
Yes. By the way, Tannery Pond, that audience is a fantastic audience, educated, listening audience. It's always a joy to play there. And then Bernie said, well, let's go a step farther. Let's go to Israel. I want you to go to Israel. I had never been to Israel before. And he said, let's go. And because my background is Jewish and then I'm a Christian. I became a Christian at a certain point in my life. So it's a real mix. And there's some Catholic stuff in my Jewish part of the family too. And so it's all a big mishmash. And of course, Israel is Israel, Palestine, and the whole Arabic culture is very much part of that whole thing. So that's in the way I play the flute too. And so all of it seemed to make a whole lot of sense. And so we all trooped over there. Bernie and a friend of his, a physician, Jim Shantz and his wife, and me. And we went and stayed in Jerusalem. So this was a joint project with the Jerusalem Foundation, which has always been talking about Jerusalem being a polycultural city, that it's not one side Arab and one side Israeli, you know, that it should be, there should be freedom between cultures there. They've been fighting for that for years. So as the current events are saying, telling us, I hope and pray that that's going to happen in peace somehow, because it's just the most natural. And being there, going there and seeing how Israelis are saying, yes, there has to be a Palestinian state. We're already building the checkpoints, and that, you know, everyone wants peace there. So to be there and to see that manifest, and then to go to the important Jewish sites and the important Christian sites, which was so important to me personally, because it's part of my journey. Because I feel like I'm an early Christian, you know, like I was one of those people who went with Jesus, who decided to go with him, you know, maybe even against my family, what they wanted, but I went right along. And so to see the sites in Jerusalem, to sit in the Garden of Gethsemane, you know, to see where he gave the Sermon on the Mount, to see the Sea of Galilee, to actually be there was just thunderous in its spiritual message.
That was such an essential thing for a lot of people to go to the Holy Land in the 19th century and visit it, perhaps, you know, not in the quantity people go today, but there would be individuals, often people of the cloth, who would go there. And there was a whole market.
It's very, very, there's a reason for it. It's not, I mean, the busloads of people, it's like going to Assisi in Italy and you see the busloads of people and, oh, another busload. But that doesn't make the place itself any less potent artistically and spiritually. If you can get there on a day when there aren't so many busloads of people around, which luckily, since we spent so much time in Italy, we were able to do. And in this case, we were there at a time of year. It was in March. It was an early spring. It was just divine. It was just about, I think we were there about 2 weeks, and we could really take all of it in. And Jim was painting, working. I was just collecting music, and I was thinking, how can I possibly express this? And then I met Leonard Bernstein wrote an important piece for flute called Halil, which is the Hebrew name for flute, and it's about Yadin Tenenbaum, who was a young Israeli soldier who was killed at the age of 18 in the war between Israel and Egypt, when Egypt invaded Israel on Yom Kippur. And the piece I've played many, many times, and I always wondered what Yadin was like. I always wondered, what was he like? I mean, who am I supposed to be? What is my motivation for this piece? And suddenly we were sitting in a cafeteria in the Yad Vashem Museum, and I said to our guide, "Hey, Ron, do you ever hear of a piece called Halil?" He said, "Oh yeah, sure, I knew Yadin. You want to talk to his sister?" So I just about died. What? And he said, "Just a minute." He called her, and of course in Israel everybody knows everybody else. And so, "Hey Ella, there's somebody here, there's a flutist." Blah, blah. Make a very long story short, I visited the family and played on Yadin's flute, which was also a tremendous experience for me personally. So finding a way to talk about it when we got back was the big challenge, especially the Arabic music, because in order to play Arabic music well, you have to play it your whole life. You know how to play the ney, you know all the scales and the modes, and it's highly complex, extremely dense, ancient civilization filled with very many arabesques. So to be able to play that music well, it was a big challenge, but finally I found a piece called Mawal, which is a meditation, which was actually written out improvisation. So, and then Jim had some beautiful images combined with that. So that we called Places of the Spirit, the Holy Land. I don't know whether we're going to do any more. We've talked about going to Japan or going to India. Maybe we'll do that. Maybe that's still in the future. Who knows?
Too. Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah, we'll see. Whatever's out there. I'm waiting for you. Well, I have to say that you coming into my life has been a tremendous gift, and I'm very, very grateful for that.
Oh, thanks so much.
I'm amazed that you've been so interested and happy about whatever it is, that thing that I do, and that you've written about it with understanding and such enthusiasm. And I have to say that your words have given me strength to go on in some of those more difficult
moments. Oh, thanks so much. That's
so, I am very, very grateful to you.
A wonderful reward in itself.
Thank you.
And it makes it all worthwhile.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, thank you, Paula.